tired of life being all about ailments and funerals. I want to push myself.
You want to hike the Appalachian Trail?
2,000 miles? You have gone mad.
It's my old pup tent.
It's the perfect place for you to spend the night.
It's Emma Thompson there. That's from the trailer of a terrific new film called A Walk in the Woods. And you might also have noticed the other voice, that's Robert Redford. It's based on Bill Bryson's best-selling memoir of the same name, A Walk in the Woods. And it's the story of his own adventures alongside a friend whom he called Stephen Katz, hiking long stretches of America's 3,300-kilometre-long Appalachian Trail. This was back in 1996. Bill has written some of my favourite books. Way back he wrote The Mother Tongue and Notes for a Small Island. He wrote a wonderful book on Shakespeare, and I'm sure you've got your favourites as well, because there are heaps of others. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, Michael.
I can't think of a more surreal cinema experience than going in to watch a movie and see yourself played by Robert Redford.
Well, particularly in my case, when I first saw the movie, I was sitting next to Robert Redford
at
the Sun Desert. He was on my right side, my wife was on my left, and I sat there thinking, this is just, you know, my brain can't really handle this, because it's just such an amazing situation to find myself
in. I don't really believe that Robert Redford is a real person. You know, if I saw him, I couldn't believe that he could be incorporated.
Well, I had exactly that experience, because, you know, I don't move in those circles. I don't live in a world in which I spend time with movie stars. But as it happened, on the day that we went to the premiere, we spent a day with him. My wife and I spent a day with him at Sundance, his resort. And it was, you know, I was constantly sort of pinching myself, because here I am on a ski lift with Robert Redford, and we're talking about, you know, his great old movies and things. So he is absolutely the most charming man you could ever imagine, and you know, really, really smart. And part of the reason I was so happy that he bought the rights and that he was the one who was developing the movie was, you know, I had this total sincere confidence from the outset that he would make an intelligent movie, that he wouldn't do anything to screw it up or embarrass me or himself or anything like that. So I, you know, my only feeling throughout the whole long, enduring process of getting this made into a movie was just curiosity. What are they going to do with it? How are they going to, what are they going to do?
Well, I hope you love the film, because I watched it a couple of nights ago and really loved it. But I now understand that he is 78 and he looks every bit of 70 something. But when you did this walk, actually, by my calculations, you were 44.
That's exactly right. Yeah. We were, I mean, our problem when we hiked the trail was not age, it was just total lack of fitness and sort of mental preparedness. We were completely out of our depths. And they had to, that was one of the adjustments they had to make in order to make it work for Robert Redford and Nick Nolte, both of whom are in their 70s. So the issue for them was much more to do with age rather than fitness. Redford in particular is quite self-evidently fit in the movie. I mean, you could imagine him scampering up a hill.
So Nick Nolte plays the mate, and Nick Nolte actually steals the film. Nick Nolte is extraordinary. In fact, I didn't know it was Nick Nolte until I saw the credits at the end. I just thought, where do they get this old geezer who is just so disgraceful in the way he talks, who can hardly take a step, and here he is trying to climb up a mountainside, and everything is like this. I'll be fine. I'll catch up. No, oh. It's like the whole way through.
He's brilliant. I agree with you. He did steal the film. The movie, I think, comes to life in a really great way when he joins the movie. And I think the one thing I thought they did spectacularly well in the film was get that chemistry between these two guys. I mean, in real life and in the movie, we really were the odd couple. There were two people who had nothing in common and all kinds of reasons for squabbling and not getting along. And in both the movie and in the real experience, you know, we developed this bond, this friendship, which was unexpected and really quite extraordinary.
So you better tell us where the Appalachian Trail is.
Well, the Appalachian Trail runs for 3,300 kilometers, as you say, from a place called Springer Mountain in Georgia in the southeastern United States, all the way up almost to the Canadian border in northern Maine. So it's really long. I mean, I suppose it's equivalent, must be like going from Sydney to Brisbane or something.
Yeah, it's a huge distance. So, if you think of the map of the United States and then just think of a line going up the right-hand side of the map, just a bit in, and ending up in Maine in the top right-hand corner there.
Yeah.
That's it.
But with a significant feature that although it's It's going up through this very populous corridor. It is the whole of the trail, virtually the whole of the trail, is in wilderness. And that is the defining thing about walking. It is that for 5 or 6 days at a time, you are out in the woods, and you, particularly in 1998, before cell phones and GPS and all these other things, you were stuck out in a very isolated situation.
Wilderness is an important idea for Americans, because I think I'm right, Bill, in saying that when an American hears the word wilderness, they hear the word wild in it. Mm-hmm. Whereas I don't think Australians do. I think they think of wilderness often just as a kind of desolate place, although now we talk about the Tasmanian wilderness as a beautiful place. But I think in Australia, traditionally, wilderness meant a sort of blasted, empty place. Whereas in America, wilderness tends to evoke the notion of mighty torrents and huge mountains.
Exactly, yes, and you know, untouched, which is what the Appalachian Trail is. I mean, the landscape around it. And it is the most extraordinary thing because, you know, it's two different places. One is the place you see as backdrop when you're just speeding along on an interstate highway. You know, you see the Appalachian Mountains, and they're there 2, 3, 5 miles away. And there's just wooded mountains, and it just is kind of part of the landscape. But you get on them, and you are suddenly in this landscape that is genuinely unchanged from the days when, you know, Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett were out there. That it is like time travel. You are stepping back to this landscape that is completely untouched and feels primeval, wonderful.
You just want to whack on a raccoon skin hat.
Well, actually, all I wanted was to, you know, get a cold beer and a hot shower. But yes, I mean, there are times when you're out there and you just think this is quite extraordinary that, you know, if you look on a map, it seems like you're really no distance at all from Washington or Baltimore or other big population centers. But on foot, you feel as if you're thousands of miles from everywhere.
So why this call of the wild? There you are, you're 44. Why did you do it? Why did you need to do it?
What happened is at that point in my life, I had just come back to America. I'd moved there with my wife and 4 kids. I had lived in England for almost 20 years at that point, and we impetuously came home, and I needed to come up with some kind of a book idea, and I had this idea that maybe it would be an interesting experience to try to reconnect with my native land by going out and walking across a big part of it. I was very struck with the existence of this immensely long footpath, and I just thought it also coincidentally it ran through the town that we had just moved to. So I just thought I'll give it a try. It just was, you know, it was. I did it without reflection. I had no, you know, no great companion in mind to do it. Katz came along with me only because he was available, not because he was an ideal choice, as you'll know if you see the movie or read the book. So it was this thing I did impetuously, and probably I think that was good for the book, but not very good for my personal sanity.
So there's no angst driving this. You're just in search of your inner American.
I was, well, and I mean, frankly, I was in search of material for a new book. I mean, that was the kind of bedrock thing about it. And I mean, I make no secret in the book, you know, that's pretty much why I'm out there. But out of all the, you know, hundreds of things I might have done in order to generate material for a new book, this was the thing that I was most keen to do.
So in the movie, your wife, played by Emma Thompson in the movie, refers to a big row that had occurred with Katz years before. Was there a big row?
Well, there wasn't really. There was more of a, I mean, again, I think this was a slight simplification they made for the purposes of the movie narrative. But what there was really was a sort of tailing off. We had been good friends when we were young in Des Moines, Iowa. And then Katz, I'd gone off and had a much more conventional life and got married and had family and jobs and career and became a writer and so on. Katz had gone in exactly the opposite direction, led a life of spectacular dissipation in Iowa. I mean, at one time he was one of only 2 opium addicts in the state of Iowa, the other one being his supplier, and just hopeless alcoholic, and just, you know, lived life to the full. Absolutely delightful human being. I mean, you know, if you were with him, you would have a great evening, but also just, you know, kind of a great wreck, and was heading for a very early grave. Well, that was why he came with me, because he was trying to recover from alcoholism. But our friendship had not ended in an argument, really. We just kind of drifted apart.
Right. So did it help him? Did he sort himself out?
Yeah, he did indeed. And it was a big part. He was really struggling with – I didn't dwell on it very much in the book to the extent that he was really struggling with alcoholism. It becomes an issue in the book, as it was, in fact, on, you know, in our experience together. But he was really struggling, and he was in a really bad place. I mean, he'd had a long-term relationship, and he was quite miserable. He was, you know, he was a real pain in the ass to be walking with at the outset. But he had the great virtue that he stayed with me. He stood by me. And as a consequence of that, we really did have a strange experience that men, I think, don't very often get. I think women have these kinds of friendship all the time, but men don't. And it was a kind of army buddy type experience where we were both in this thing together and really ended up kind of pulling each other along.
Has it made you better at friendship?
Well, it certainly has with him. I mean, the one lasting consequence of this is that I normally call him quite regularly. I live in England again, and he's in the middle of the United States. But I have great concern for him. I mean, I've reached a point now where I'm quite content that he is on the, you know, he's behaving himself and he hasn't had a drink for a long time. But I do still check in with him in a way that I don't think I would have if we hadn't had this experience together.
Because really in the film, Nick Nolte's journey as Katz is the biggest journey. It's the kind of moral arc of the film because he is redeemed by the journey.
Yeah. And Katz, his real name is Matt, was too to a certain extent, although it's not part of the book. But I mean, when our summer ended and he went back home to Iowa, you know, he has stayed sober ever since. I think he had one little stumble, a lost weekend in there somewhere. But essentially, in the last 17 years or whatever it is, he has been completely sober. He got a job, a steady job. He found a really nice woman whom he subsequently married. His whole life became, you know, he straightened himself out.
My guest this morning is Bill Bryson, and we're talking about his book, A Walk in the Woods, which has just been made into a film, a lovely film, I saw it last week, starring Robert Redford as Bill Bryson. So there are really two Americas in this story. There's the America that's embodied in the myth of the wilderness, mm-hmm. and then there's the America that keeps reasserting itself, the America you stumble into on the trail. Suddenly you're back in shopping, the world of shopping malls and motels and so on. They seem to embody two quite different mythologies about what it means to be American.
Yeah, and it is a genuinely surreal experience. You go out onto the trail. The whole thing about the trail is, I mean, it's exercise and deprivation. You are without all of the comforts that you normally have and all the things that you routinely take for granted. And then you step back from time to time. You know, what happens is the trail crosses the highway every few days, and on those occasions, you know, every 5 or 6 days, you need to walk into or hitchhike into a town and resupply, buy more groceries, more food, and so on. And on those occasions, you go back and you are suddenly thrust into this very lively, very convenient, very appealing, but also just, you know, really quite ugly modern world that's full of just commercial activity.
And how conscientious is that modern America about caring for that more mythological America, the America of the Appalachian Trail?
Almost not at all. I mean, that was a big part of the book is this sense that people really ought to get out here and see this trail. And there's still a tension there, an interesting tension that I'm experiencing secondhand right now, because a lot of people in America who are keen walkers on the Appalachian Trail don't like the idea of this movie coming out, because I think they think that it's going to attract more people to the trail and that it'll be, you know, lots of not very serious hikers will go out there and experience it, which I think is a wonderful thing. I mean, it's something that everybody should see. But they think, I think other people think that it's going to spoil the trail. And there's this feeling among a lot of people that it's this sort of this special little secret that they want to keep secret.
Well, I understand. Every time someone makes a film about a Greek island, suddenly the Greek island is sinking beneath the tourists. So I do get that idea. So how many people would walk the trail a year, do you know?
I did know, but I think, I can't remember, but I it wasn't that many. I think it was, from end to end, it was just a few hundred
right.
at the time I
who,
did
who
it.
Could actually make it. So, I mean, the reality is that you don't make it. You actually walk more in reality than the film suggests you did. You walked an extraordinary distance.
We walked the equivalent of going from New York to Chicago.
Yeah, that's a walk.
That's a pretty good summer's hike. Yeah, but what we did, and what we did was, I mean, I set out with the very sincere intent of walking every step of the way. And I felt, really, you know, if you're going to write a book about it, you've got to do that. I mean, that's a sort of minimum requirement to do it. And quite early on, within a week or two, we realized, I'm not going to do this. It's more than I can do. Yeah. Not physically so much as mentally. It's just, this is more of a commitment than I can make. And I had some agonizing over that for a couple of days. But then I was actually liberated by it. And what we did after that was we just walked the sections we're still enjoying walking, so we just did the parts that were pleasurable. We did the most beautiful parts, the national parks, the Smokies and Shenandoah National Park and places like that, New England, where the landscape is spectacular. Because if you're honest about it, if you know the Appalachian Trail, an awful lot of it is really just connective tissue. It's just getting you across Pennsylvania or Delaware or whatever. And it isn't really, in terms of the reward, it isn't necessary to walk all those bits.
You're talking to me as if you have to convince me that it was virtuous to do it the way you did it. I'm totally convinced, Bill. I'm with you. Because I've had your wife's experience of having my wife, who is a writer, suddenly deciding she's going to go off on a cockamamie walk. She decided, this is about 5 years ago, she decided she was going to walk across England.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she did this, the coast-to-coast walk in England, and off she went with two friends to walk across England. She just felt, as a writer, she needed to do it. So I was back in Australia thinking, oh, Lord, I hope she's all right. And every day Googling the weather in the Lakes District, and there was literally cyclones and storms, and I imagined my wife out there, and of course she couldn't reach me. And so I'm totally with you. And it left me wondering what it is about writers, because there are so many writers who want to walk. You know, I'm going to talk to the British author Will Self at the Melbourne Writers Festival. He's an insane walker.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, he loves to walk. Chaucer. There's a walker. I started with Chaucer, William Blake, Wordsworth, Dickens, Mark Twain, all walkers.
I've actually wondered about that at times because, I do really enjoy walking. And I really enjoy it. But if you had me do all the same things I'm doing when I'm walking, like just, but not walking, I'd hate it. I'd be bored out of my mind. If I had to sit still and do what I'm doing when I'm walking, because when I'm walking, I'm just sort of mindlessly thinking and my brain isn't going very much. If I had to do that sitting in a chair, I'd go crazy. But somehow when your legs are moving, it becomes invigorating. And I've never really quite figured out why that should be.
When I've been out in the Australian bush, especially in the outback camping, I've found that at night, sitting gazing at the fire, that you don't feel the need to talk. People just look at the fire and they don't say very much. And the sensations become more intense. Like, you make a pot of tea and it's just the best tea you've ever had. Or just you eat some bread and it just tastes like something that the gods would have munched on. Have you had that sensation?
Yeah, when I write about that, Troy, I think what I said was something to the effect of, where a piece of pie takes you to the very brink of orgasm. And it really is like that, because you just, there is something about, you're driving your body and you're forcing yourself to require a lot of nutrition and input, but in a healthy way. And it's also the deprivation, as I say, that you're going days and days without hot meals or hot showers. I can remember just the glory of getting a hot shower when you haven't had any water on your skin for 5 or 6 days, and you can actually feel every droplet. It's so exquisite.
Yeah, you can't believe it. Yeah. I know that experience. So you wrote this book in the 1990s, so this is a slightly odd thing that you're back now spruiking a book that is so much in your past. What are you working at the moment?
Oh, I've just finished, really literally just finished, a new book. It's the 20th anniversary this year of a book I did in Britain called Notes from a Small Island, which was my traveling around Britain. And my publisher in London prevailed upon me to do a sequel. So I've done a book, and it's called The Road to Little Dribbling. And it's me looking at Britain. Essentially just an opportunity for me to make fun of the British again after a lapse of 20 years. Yeah. And I've had the time of my life.
You know, serve it up.
Yeah. I mean, I do. I love Britain. I love the British. That's why I live there, and I very much admire them, but I also continue to think that they are the world's craziest, most misguided people in so many ways. And so it's a chance to talk about why I like them, but also how they continue to mystify me. I've known them for 40 years now, and I'm still bewildered by
them. You continue to live among them.
Exactly.
Bill Bryson, it's been a total pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much.
Bill Bryson. So A Walk in the Woods will be in cinemas across the country from the 3rd of September. And look, it'll be a great film to see at the weekend. If you've got an older person who you sometimes take to the movies, like I'm going to take my mum to this. She'll really, really love it. And I loved it too.